Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening for those of you who may be watching it in a different location. Arizona is so weird. We're still on daylight time until Sunday night at, you know, or Sunday morning at 1 a.m. So it's confusing to everyone. Bonnie McBird will be joining us very shortly to talk about What Child Is This? But meantime, we have Leslie S. Klinger, former Sherlockian annotator and general all-around fabulous guy. So Les, let's talk about the Library of Congress Crime Classics for a minute, because you're the series editor. What's hot at the Library of Congress?
Well, we have some exciting new titles coming out. First, let me think, I want to get the order right. We have Room to Swing by Ed Lacy, which is the Edgar-winning novel from 1957. It's the first Black PI. Lacy is an interesting guy. His real name was Lenny Zinberg, and he was a white Jewish boy from Brooklyn, but he was married to a Black woman and knew the community very well. He was a real leftist, a real commie pinko type. And it's a powerful book, very sympathetic to the plight of Harlem residents at the time and continuing, and a great mystery, as well as interesting sociological background. So that is, I believe, the next title. Coming right after that is The Master of Mysteries, which couldn't be more different. Master of Mysteries is 1911. And it stars Astro the Seer, who is admittedly a phony astrologer who works for a lot of rich people in New York. And he uses detective skills, basically, to help them with cases. The stories were written by Gelett Burgess, who is best known as the author of the Purple Cow Limerick. And was a well-regarded humorist of the day, but he also wrote this wonderful series of mystery stories. They're really charming and a lot of fun to read. There's a romance even as part of it.
Interesting that people were driven to use pen names for writing mystery. Why was that? You know, was it something to be ashamed of? Was it something they thought,
Back to Lacy. Lacy was writing right at the moment when paperbacks were sort of coming into their own. And you are not old enough to remember that the Mystery Writers of America did not allow paperback writers as members. And there was no category for Edgar's for paperback originals and all that. So Zinberg had actually published a few titles in hardcover under his own name, and subsequently, when he broke into the paperback market, adopted this pen name of Ed Lacy.
Okay, so it's just it was a pragmatic publishing decision.
Yes.
So
yes.
Bonnie's coming to join us. Hi, Bonnie.
All the way from London. That plane was late.
Well, so sorry, guys. I'm sorry. Hello.
It's no problem at all. We were talking about the Library of Congress Crime Classics. And before we segue over to Bonnie's wonderful book, I'm just going to finish and say that the one title that I espoused and argued for and bullied everybody into publishing was The Metropolitan Opera Murders by Helen Trumbull, which is a recent Library of Congress crime classic. And Les tells me it's doing extremely well.
Yes, and it's a terrific fun to read. She was an amazing woman, and the story is kind of an insider's look behind the scenes at the Met. So,
yep, she was the foremost Wagnerian soprano of her day. And if you know anything about opera, you will also know who did it before you ever start. But nonetheless, it's really fun. And I'm so glad that the library brought it back. So, Bonnie. Wonderful.
Hello.
What Child Is This? A Christmas Story. It's actually, it's an interesting book. I would say that it comes reasonably, it's short. And you know what it made me think of? It made me think of O. Henry and the Gift of the Magi.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's well, it's a novella.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, because, you know, the Gift of the Magi was about, you know, how to make the people trying to please each other, but how to make the best of choices that maybe they regretted. And I really enjoyed the way this resolves, but we're not here to talk about how it resolves. We're here to talk about how it starts. So Leslie probably is better qualified. Well, I know he's better qualified to talk to Bonnie about Sherlock Holmes than I am. So I think I'll shut up and let him do that.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I'd like to take full credit for Bonnie writing these brilliant novels, but that would be completely wrong because Bonnie has been a writer for a lot longer than I have. What I do take credit for is loudly saying, go, Bonnie, go.
Yes, you did. You do,
and,
you did.
And I'm so glad, and the readers worldwide have benefited from that. So, Bonnie, this is your fifth outing now with Holmes.
Yeah.
Is it getting old? Is it getting stale? Conan Doyle, we knew, was sick of him after 24 short stories. So,
oh, no, it hasn't gotten old at all. I mean, I love it now as much as I did the first day. I don't think I'll ever get sick of Holmes. No, I'm working on number six right now. So,
so why should the readers care? Why should readers want to read a new story about Sherlock Holmes? We already have 60 by that other guy, Dr.
Yeah,
Watson.
Right. You know, we got 60 by the original. Yeah. Well, you know, it's just such a time. Well, it's a timeless character, also the first superhero, but particularly right now, I think he's just, Holmes' story just fits the zeitgeist. We need reassurance. We need scientific rationality to overcome magical thinking, and we need to know that there's a good end, and we're guaranteed that with the Holmes story.
True. I mean, we hope. I don't know. You know, the readers have to find out if there's a good end here. Yeah, I mean, I think Holmes, people want to go back and read the originals for, I think, the very reasons that you've said. And, you know, because they're so wonderful, it's like, I want more.
Yeah.
I think
yeah,
that's what definitely got you into this. I assume
absolutely.
It was just more.
They just want more, exactly. I mean, Nick Meyer says the same thing, really, is basically just want more. There's just something, the particular journey of these stories, of these books, is just so satisfying because, you know, it gives you all the stuff of a good mystery. It gives you a problem to solve and an apparent thing that doesn't look really solvable, but this really smart guy will do it. However, you feel smart while you're on the ride with him, which is really nice. And the other thing it does, I think that better than really any other, famous detective, is that it gives you this friendship, this other whole dimension of the friendship with Watson. And I think that's such a satisfying world to inhabit. So not only do you have the fascination of the late Victorian era and all its, you know, connections to current day and all some very exciting things there, but then you have this rooting with, you're just along with your best friend. And I feel like when I read a Holmes story, it's like I want a friend like Watson, but I also want to be a friend like Watson. There's just something very satisfying about that particular that doorway into the mystery.
I think most of us would rather be Watson than Holmes. I mean, Holmes is just, he's uncomfortable.
Yes, yes. Let me just read something from page 81 on this very topic, because it really struck me, Bonnie, when you wrote that. Sorry, that's my puppy. For such an unsociable man, Holmes seemed to be effortless in attracting allies as needed. But despite this notable ability, Holmes had few actual friends. I have often considered that I am perhaps his only true friend. I love that page. I really thought about that because it is true in the stories. Watson is his friend, but he doesn't really collect others, except maybe the Baker Street Irregulars. What do you think, Les?
I'm not sure. I think that there it's more of a mentoring relationship than it is friendship. They're not old enough. I mean, it's interesting to imagine Wiggins or some of the older boys coming back 10, 20 years later. And some writers have imagined that. But we didn't see that in the original stories. Bonnie, I wanted to ask you about what's your aim. So is your aim to make the stories that you write sort of fit seamlessly into the canon, or are you trying to explore aspects of Holmes that maybe aren't covered there? I don't mean the events, I mean the character.
Both. I guess. So yeah, that is a really good question, Les. So I guess when I sat down to start this, what I decided was I didn't want to conflict with anything in canon, first of all.
Okay.
So I wanted it to feel like it seamlessly fit in. In other words, Watson doesn't have an extra wife, although it's confusing which ones he has even in the canon. But I didn't want to obviously conflict in any way. So Holmes doesn't have characteristics that he doesn't have in the canon, and neither does Watson. I mean, I made the characters, I'm cleaving to the original genius invention of Conan Doyle. So I don't want to conflict with canon.
But you have filled in some of the blanks.
I have, and that's the other thing. I wanted, in because these are novels, and he wrote short stories and novellas. Well, this last one's a novella, but most of them that I do are novels. Because they're novels, they require a little more character development. And so I thought, okay, that is fun and fascinating to me as a writer, but I want to do that super carefully, because one of the attractions of Holmes, and a lot of Sherlockians will talk about this, you especially, Les, and others as well, that Holmes himself is a bit of a mystery. He's a cipher, and that's one of his attractions, because the things that are missing in the description of him, we don't know all his history. That's things we fill in with ourselves, and that's why partly why we connect so deeply to this character. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't want to remove all the mystique. I don't want to explain his entire childhood, explain how he is about women, explain how, you know, some of the mysteries, but I did want to like touch around the edges of that, because that's fun and interesting, and I think the readers will really enjoy that, as long as I don't cross over that line and try to explain too much. Because then,
yeah,
that's,
I mean, this is really interesting what you said about the mystery. I worked with Robert Downey Jr. on the first Sherlock Holmes film, and as we talked about Holmes, he really liked the gaps, the mysteries.
Yes.
Because it gave him the opportunity as an actor to fill those in.
Right.
Or to really find his own motivations for it. Let's put it that way. So, but you said something earlier that I wanted to talk a little bit about, and that is the linkages sort of between the Victorian age and today. The topics that you cover in this book, and I think we can discuss them without spoilers, child care, for example, you know, are super relevant today. And was that a choice? I mean, obviously, yeah, it was a major issue in Victorian times, but.
Yes, yeah. I always start my projects with a title. So this one, What Child Is This, came to me instantly because it's a famous Christmas song, of course. There's 2000 versions of What Child Is This on Spotify, just as an example, but, you know, to the tune of Greensleeves. I mean, that title evoked something about, okay, a child is missing, a child is kidnapped, a child is taken, or there's an identity issue with a child. That's What Child Is This seemed to be about identity. So I started thinking about what it's like to be a child in that time. And, you know, of course, there's a massive social disparity then. I mean, there is now too. I was just saying to someone, you walk around London today and you see homeless people sleeping in doorways. At Holmes's time, there were four times that number of homeless people sleeping in doorways and alleys, and it was much colder then. The temperature was different in the winter, much more snow. So the thing is, what is it, the vulnerability of a child, and also they didn't have all the child protection laws that we have now. So children were regularly conscripted into factory work as low-level servants in big houses where they were, you know, they worked to exhaustion. Children who found themselves in the workhouse, that was a terrible place to be as a child. I mean, it's a tragedy in the making if you're in the workhouse as a child. So, you know, we all know this somewhat from Dickens, but even later in the century at Holmes' time, it was a very tough time to be, unless you were wealthy in a wealthy family. It was a tough time.
Of course, child prostitution was also rampant.
Oh, yes. There was just no protection things. There was nothing to protect them in place. You know, there were small groups. I mean, the late Victorian era saw a lot of kind of do-gooder groups arise, people that were trying to, you know, temperance groups and, you know, people that were trying to, you know, contain the more dangerous aspects of society or help in some way. But children weren't you know, as a general rule, they were just not protected. And so, you know, yeah, they could, they were kind of, there was a trade basically in children. I mean, they're workers or whatever. And so, and the laws of adoption were not so clear. They were not strict. So one of the things that this book talks about is there's the parentage of this one child is in question. And the laws that pertain to that would determine who got him, who was awarded custody of this child, were not clear. You couldn't necessarily count on them. And so, you know, a child's life and happiness were definitely in the balance. But the other thing is I wanted to present a story in which there isn't really an obvious answer, because it's something clever has to happen. Of course, we know who's clever. So we're going to rely on Holmes to come up with some kind of solution where there doesn't look like there's going to be a solution. In order to do that in this particular story, he has to call on something that we don't usually see in him. And that is a moment where I wanted to build on what I know of Holmes from the canon and extrapolate and show the larger Holmes and his ability to really be human, which you see in The Blue Carbuncle.
Yeah. So, then, by the way, let's be clear, because I'm sure we have some non-Sherlockians in the audience here. When we talk about, there are some in the world. I understand.
I guess there are.
not that our patrons of the Poison Pen Bookshop. I mean, every Poison Pen customer, I'm sure, is dedicated to Holmes. But the point I was going to make is the canon. When we talk about the canon, we're talking about these 60 stories that have the name Arthur Conan Doyle attached to them as the purported author, most of which were written by Dr. Watson and a few by other people. We're not talking about Bonnie's wonderful books. Those are additions to the canon, if you will.
Are you including the novels, Wes?
Yes, there are 56 short stories and 4 novels. Okay. That form the canon. In two of them purport to be written by Holmes himself. And one of them is written in the third person. It's very different from the other stories. And so there have been arguments about who wrote that story. And the stories that were written by Holmes are probably, I mean, I guess most scholars would agree that they probably were written by Holmes, because they're not nearly as good as the ones written by Watson. So that's why I say Watson wrote most of the stories. So,
that's so funny.
Well, Watson wrote the ones that I have found also, as you know.
Of course.
Isn't it convenient that there was a gap while Holmes, you know, went missing over Reichenbach Falls and
us? It really is astonishing. I've talked about this many times about the overlap of the lives of Watson and Holmes and Conan Doyle. And so that you understand what Barbara's talking about, in 1891, Holmes goes over the Reichenbach Falls, according to the story, and he's not to be seen in London. And so at that point in time, Dr. Watson picks up his pen and begins to write the series of short stories about Sherlock Holmes. Before that time, there were only 2 stories published, A Study in Scarlet and The Sign of 4. So then we have this gap, and the short stories began to appear in 1891 in the Strand magazine and 1892. And then Watson tells us that in 1893, Holmes comes back from the dead. He was not, in fact, lost over the Reichenbach Falls. And what we understand is that Holmes said to him, "Stop writing stories. I don't like it. It's bad for my business. I don't want you to write more stories." And in fact, no new stories appeared between 1893 and 1901. And in 1901, the story that appeared, which is The Hound of the Baskervilles, is clearly a reminiscence of Holmes's activities before the Reichenbach Falls. So all of the stories that appear between 1891 and 1893 are pre-Holmes's death, are pre-Reichenbach Falls stories. It isn't until 1903 that the public learned that Holmes was in fact alive. Right. This is true. I didn't make up any of that part.
So. You know, you know, what's fascinating to me is that, you know, so many people have imagined he was in Tibet, he was in Minnesota. You know, I mean, it's a godsend to people who want to, you know, figure out what he was actually doing during this long period of time.
Well, that's a great segue to my next question for you, Bonnie, which is, you've been in London now for 3 years, I guess. 3 years? Yeah.
Yeah.
Free of the influence, the pernicious influence of Los Angeles. How has it changed your writing? How has it changed your writing approach, your storytelling?
Oh, gosh. Well, the location of London has changed my approach less than have the fact of the pandemic and being basically in this room for 3 years. So in this room, pretty much most of the time. I've been on lockdown tighter than most people and for longer than most people, because I think, you know, Alan got ill and he's immune compromised. So if I bring COVID home to him, it's extremely dangerous. So I've been pretty much locked down. So what that's meant to my writing is just that I've had to do my research online more than, because I normally location scout just as I would for a movie when I write these things. So I've been to Paris and I've been to the Highlands of Scotland. I've been to the island of Isla. I've been all over the place, to Cambridge, Sodera, for these various books. But this one, I just got to be here. But I have to say that I do walk around my flat.
And you can look out your window, you know.
I do. And I can see the Baker Street tube station from my window. I'm that close to, and I'm literally like kind of right over the street from the Sherlock Holmes statue, which I can't see from my window because there's a stone wall behind it. But I am right in the heart of Sherlock Holmes territory, and I do walk around my neighborhood. And so that does influence me. There's just something very essential about the ambience. But I have to say, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you spent quite a bit of time there yourself, Les.
I did.
And the weather where I grew up in South San Francisco is pretty much identical to London. So it feels like home.
Not quite as much snow as in San Francisco as in London, but not very much in London either. But
no, I've been here for much of the time for the last 8 years, and it's snowed briefly, like twice. Like it doesn't even like last on the ground, really. So very little snow. But in the late Victorian times, like when this book is set, it was snowing a lot. I mean, the weather was different back then. It was much colder.
One of the key locations, as I recall, is the docks. That's where some of the
not for this book, but The Devil's Due has a big scene at on the Thames at the Isle of Dogs.
So there's a whole bunch of scenes sort of down in the, I don't know, you know what to call it, the poor area where the workhouses
it's around near Aldgate and Whitechapel and that sort of eastern end of the poor end of London at the time. Now it's kind of chic. Some of the area there is kind of hip and happening. But at that time it was very, it was very desolate. And so there are alleyways filled with refuse and, you know, millions of people crammed into, you know, terrible lodgings and, you know, laundry hanging out and freezing on the lines and, you know,
and
it was very Dickensian. I mean, even still at that time and, you know, and the people who lived there, you know, they couldn't get any rest. They could noise and dirt and disease and just poverty. It was just incredibly difficult for the people trying to live there. And that's one of the circumstances of some of the characters in this Christmas story. You know, and then contrast that with a very wealthy family in Mayfair and how they lived. And then, of course, Holmes and Watson are somewhere in the middle there. They're just sort of middle class. Americans, we would call it middle class. And they, you know, they're comfortable and safe, et cetera. What's interesting, you know, the Booth poverty maps, you know about these, right?
Sure.
I know you do, but maybe some of the listeners don't. There's a set of maps. I think it was 1887 or 1889 guy named Booth went around and mapped every block of London, and every building really, and he color coded them as to their economic level. And so you can go look at, I have the huge printed volume of this in here, but you can also see it online, and you can do it. Blend where you can see it then and now. You can do that online. Anyway, so but what's interesting is that Baker Street and this Marylebone area is the same now as it was then. It's a kind of a upper middle class with a lot of commercial stuff woven into it. It's exactly the same. Where, you know, many of the other areas of London have changed, and they've shifted and gotten very wealthy or gotten, you know, kind of deteriorated, and they've changed over time. This area has stayed exactly as it was.
So tell us a little more about your research, George Sims, How the Poor Live, those kind of things. Is that what you got into?
Yeah, yes. I read a fair amount about, although there's not a scene actually set in the workhouse, some of the backstory has to do with the Marylebone Workhouse, which existed. It was the largest workhouse in London at the time. And it was a mixed blessing. I mean, people went there because their alternative was to freeze or starve to death in the streets. And that's the only reason you went to the workhouse, because it was not a nice place to be. It was literally out. I live in an 1890 building here, and out my back window looked down onto the Marylebone Workhouse, like right there out that window. And in fact, I have a map of it. My window looked out on the Insane Men's Courtyard of the Marylebone Workhouse, which is crazy. But I read quite a bit about that, and that helped me imagine the mindset of people who were constrained to go there or to be there, and how they would want to get out and what they would do to try to get out, and how children who were born into that situation, what became of them. And so that was a really interesting set of research that I did for this book. I had to be online because I was stuck here in this room.
How does that compare to, I mean, is that a solution for today's homeless problems? Or, I mean, What was the failure of the idea of the workhouse?
Good question. I think, there wasn't training involved, so there wasn't really a way out of there. So once you were in there, you were put. What happened was, if you went into the workhouse, you had to give them your clothes. And they took your clothes off and washed them and fumigated them in sulfur and kept them and gave you a uniform. And then they put you to work, because your work, it's the workhouse. You're working to pay your room and board. And you slept in a huge dormitory, and you ate in a huge dining hall. The men separated from the women, the couples were separated, et cetera. And you were put to work, but you couldn't leave because you would be stealing the clothes you were wearing. And then you would be arrested for theft and thrown into jail. So you couldn't really leave, and you're working really, really hard, but you couldn't make enough to save to get out of there. So there was no real... The problem really was that there was no way out, really. There was no, you know, a few people made it out, but many people didn't. And it was, you know, it was debilitating and shaming. And it was sort of like a last stop for a lot of people. And it saved them from starving in the streets, but, you know, it's understandable why people tried to avoid it at all, because it was just one step up from jail, really. So I think that the reason they don't exist now is because there was no rehabilitation or work program built into these that functioned. And that's why they didn't really work.
Sounds like a not untypical example of sort of the British hypocrisy of, you know, while we're doing good things, just not sort of thinking through. And it was more about getting the people off the streets.
It was getting the people off the streets. But there was a usually a large religious overtone to these things. So, for example, just in the workhouse right behind me here, where in the dormitories, they had big arched construction over the tall rooms, and they would have religious sayings in there, and there was religious training trying to, as if being poor was a moral failing, really. I mean, they looked at being poor as a moral failing. Now, sure, some of the people were alcoholics and drug addicts, and that is how they sunk to their level, but not all of them were. And so, you know, to overlay this kind of righteousness of, you know, like if you get religion, you'll pull yourself out of this. What they really needed was, you know, of course, work training, and some of them needed psychotherapy, but, you know, there's a lot of things they needed. And that's, you know, it continues to be a problem. And we have a massive homeless problem now, you know, in our world today. And the problem is, you know, and some people attribute that to, you know, the failure of the mental health system and the closing of mental health facilities and, you know, and then no job training thing. I mean, there's lots of, it's a big complex problem that still exists. And this was an effort, truly an effort to help people. And it did keep them alive. They were clean, they had food, and they had a place to sleep that was safe. They wouldn't be robbed or beaten while they're trying to sleep. So, you know, it offered a respite, but it didn't offer a way out.
All right. Well, I know that there's always a large segment of the audience that is very interested in how things get written. So you talk a little bit about your craft and sort of how you approach a story. Do you outline? Do you work disciplined hours? And
Sure, be happy to talk about that. I have a method, and it's evolved over time, but it I don't outline. I'm more of a pantser, they call it. I'm writing by the seat of the pants. But I do start with something. I start with a title, I start with a year, and I start with a theme. I always have a theme. And you don't really necessarily think of a theme connected to genre fiction. Usually genre fiction is a whodunit, a howdunit, or a, you know, it's a thriller, it's a something, but you don't think of theme. But I do, because I think there's much to be explored in the parallels of Holmes's time and our own, and I just like that underlay for the longer works. So anyway, so I started with "What Child Is This?" is the title, and that had to be about two sons. It had to be about questions of identity, and I started to look at what it meant to be a son, and what could be a problem around that at this time. So I start with that. I usually then come up with what is the crime and who did it. And what I don't know is how Holmes figures that out. I start not knowing that, but I know that that's what he's got to do. I started to work backwards, and I sit down. I write every single day, 7 days a week. And I write first thing in the morning. And while I'm drafting, I write to word count. I sit down, I have a word count goal, and I hit that word count and don't stop until I have that. Now, that doesn't mean it's a perfect, like it's 500 words that are perfect and are going to end up in the final thing. No, it's 500 words of a draft. And if I feel like going longer, fine, but I have to hit that number. That's a fairly conservative number. And some people might go, oh, that's so slow. I would go much faster than that. And some people do. I'm a tortoise, and I just march on and I get the thing done. And I know when I get up in the morning and I don't feel like it, and I have a headache and I don't think I can have any ideas, and I can do my 500, and by God, I will. So I find that as a writer, when I set a goal for myself that I can consistently hit, then I win day after day after day. That builds my own strength. And so that's what I advise my writing students and so forth to do. People tend to want to, like, I want to write, you know, three chapters today. And it's like, dial that back to something that's doable and hit it, absolutely hit it. So yeah, I'm a kind of very diligent worker, and I've learned to work through. We had construction in the flat below us that made noise for a year and a half. My husband got very, very ill, was hospitalized. I mean, we've had quite a few stressors here. And I just
he took up the loot. That was clearly a distraction.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, I just block out stuff and just do it.
You're also a big believer in writers groups. And you want to tell us why and how you use a writers group?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm a member of actually two different writers groups. They're crit groups, and they're the first one is a very professional group of colleagues who you know quite well.
I know, and I saw Harley last night. So
that's right, at the Robert Crace
at the Robert Crace event. And by the way, yeah. Bob is not coming your way, Barbara, right? He's going to be online with you at some point, I hope.
Which one?
Bob Crace.
No, we haven't done anything with Bob for years, but that's another story. So
okay,
we'll just go right along.
Moving right along. So in any event, yes. So back to the writers groups, with Harley and you and a bunch of others.
Yeah, Matt Whitten, a lot of people. Anyway, so we meet weekly and we bring in a chapter or whatever we're working on, and we read it aloud to the group. The group gives you honest and tough criticism, but you know, they also know what it feels like to be a writer, and so they're careful in their criticism, and then, you know, and it's extremely helpful. So I do that weekly. I have another group that I formed actually mostly of my former students. I taught writing for 11 years at UCLA Extension. And quite a few of my friends from that are in my other group. And so anyway, what's nice about that is because writing is such a solitary pursuit, I'm an extrovert. I terribly miss the contact and the interaction with other writers. I miss that so bad, I can't tell you. And this helps me because we do it online, obviously, every week. And they're from all over the world, really. So they're different places.
Great. Can you tell us a little about number six?
Sure. Yeah, I'm right in the throes of it now. It's called A Serpent Under, and has to do with treachery. And I found some interesting arenas to cover. Of course, there's snakes and stuff in it, but there's all kinds of weird, interesting things. There was something called the Japanese Village that was a tourist attraction at the time. There's gypsies, there's all kinds of extraneous things that make you that don't seem to connect, but of course Holmes will connect the dots. So I'm doing the research on that. I'm traveling on my computer, but also I've contacted people by phone and Zoom, doing some research over Zoom with various experts on that as well. So I'm about 35,000 words in on that one now.
Wow. So we'll be back next year with that one, maybe.
I hope usually they've been taking me about 2 years to write. What Child Is This was a little quicker because it's a shorter piece. But usually they take me about 2 years.
So let's talk about the bonus feature of this book. Super bonus. Illustrations by the genius Frank Cho. How did that come about?
Oh, well, through the BSI, which came about from you, Les. You got me into that by, you know, saying you need to start coming to the weekends. There's an example. Yeah, Barbara's holding it up. One of my favorites of Holmes playing at the very end of the piece. Frank Cho, I saw his work on the BSI programs. Beautiful line work.
Baker Street Irregulars, for those who don't understand what we're talking about. So
yeah. Yes, the Baker Street Irregulars, which meets in a huge event every January in New York. Anyway, so I saw his work on, and he loves Franklin Booth, who is an illustrator of the end of the 19th, early 20th century. We both love his work. And he did this beautiful, intricate line work he's just got a very specialized style, and Frank has emulated that, and we both kind of love that. So I actually approached him and I said, you know, would you be interested in illustrating this? And I approached HarperCollins and said, would you be interested in having this Marvel superstar illustrate the book? And they were very excited, so they made the deal with Frank, and he did these beautiful things. I have the originals right here. You want me to hold one?
Oh,
up?
Wow. No, but don't tell our friend Jerry Margolin. He'll want them all.
I'll show you.
I think they're wonderful. I've actually been pushing this as an ideal Christmas present, and in part because of the drawings, which are so wonderful. And let's not forget too, Bonnie, while you're doing that the capital, you know, very much like a medieval manuscript.
Right,
you know,
colophons.
That are
rock caps. Sorry. Yes, drop caps. Yes.
Yeah, wonderful.
So, Bonnie, you illustrated some of your other ones yourself.
I illustrated the first one in a very different style. I used ink and black and white watercolor in the style of Sidney Paget. They're framed on the back behind me on the wall back there. that was a different. I did that for the first one, and Otto Penzler did a special edition of that book, which contained all of those illustrations. And for most of the books, I do interesting drop caps that have a little picture that corresponds with the chapter in each drop cap. I didn't do that in this one because it seemed to conflict with Frank's beautiful illustrations. So we just did something kind of a simple decorative drop cap, but I like to evoke the feel of a 19th century book with
right. And of course, the Strand Magazine famously had an illustration on every page spread, every 2 pages. Barbara, is this interesting to readers? Are they?
Oh, I think so. It comes up all the time. We did the book launch for Rhys Bowen last night, and one of the questions that came from the audience was all about the covers and the cover design and the artistry. And Rhys explained that she knew the artist and worked with him. I think that that fans are often very interested. And I, what I liked is this one, the fruit basket, because you talk about, and I thought that seeing the basket made it more real for the reader. In fact, Liz, I'm hoping that there is kind of a greater move towards having illustrations as part of the text again. That hasn't happened, but one of my favorite books of this year was last fall, I've lost track. It's by Jason Recollect called Hidden Pictures. And one of the characters, her entire voice is through a set of drawings. She's a child, a set of black and white drawings she does. And as the drawings progress, when you get to the final drawing, her whole story is revealed in that final drawing.
Wow.
She doesn't have a voice in the manuscript. And I absolutely love that. And I'm hoping that there will be, because graphic novels, which are sort of like upgraded comic book in some respects, but with more text, I don't know exactly what you call a graphic novel, I think are rising, in popularity.
Well, I'm a big lover of illustrations. I mean, right. my Jekyll and Hyde has 150 illustrations.
That's right. So. And your H.P. Lovecraft, Mr. Lovecraft for us. And we sold all the Jekyll and Hyde, but we haven't sold all the Lovecraft at the moment because we got some new ones. And I think that that's an integral part. So I always advertise your books as the annotated, illustrated edition.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the reason they're illustrated is because they're drawn from magazines. Right. Weird Tales was illustrating all of Lovecraft's work. Certainly, yeah. Holmes has a long tradition of illustration going all the way back to the originals, but not just the originals. I mean, many, many editions. So it's great, Bonnie, that you're bringing that back.
I've wanted them all along. And in fact, HarperCollins declined to use my illustrations in their edition of Art in the Blood. And their argument was that it looked like a children's book. And it's like, I don't think so. But anyway, but I felt it would look more like a 19th century book. And Otto went with it and he sold out of that special edition. And I would love to see illustrations come back. Same reason you do, both of you do, really. And I've been very pleased with my cover designs. As you can see, they're behind me. Oops, they're over there. Each one of them is based on a photograph. And with the exception of the first book, I've provided the photographs that I had taken and I posed the actors and costumed them. And,
You have a strong visual streak in between them. Yes. That comes from your movie background and your own artistry.
Think that Sidney Paget had a tremendous amount to do with, he established those iconic images of Holmes, with the deerstalker and the pike and the whole bit. I don't know that Holmes would have, achieved that without the Paget illustrations to go with the stories. I thought they went together. And I'm trying to remember some of that, like pre-Raphaelite illustrations that went with some of those big novels at the end of the 19th century. And I've always thought that that was part of their success, when you had all those women in, long flowing gowns and long flowing hair and the night.
And it continued. I mean, I have in my Victorian crime fiction collection, a number of books that have, this is up till like 1920, that have illustrations because, no, they don't have lots, nothing like the Strand Magazine of one every 2 pages, but they'll have a 4 or 5 in a novel. So good for you, Bonnie. That's great, and I hope HarperCollins will come around and say, where are the illustrations when you turn in the next one? So
I love the illustrations, and it was so fun to work with Frank. He's a character, and he's so talented, and I just love what he did, really.
Well, this is our British Crime Club Christmas selection, and I made it partly because of the seasonal nature of the story. And of course, you know, anyone should read a Sherlock Holmes story, whether they ever have or not. But also part of it was the illustrations. I think it makes it a really lovely gift book.
Oh, thank you, Barbara. Thank you so much for that. You know, I sent you book plates, signed book plates, and bookmarks, which they didn't go out until just recently, but you should be getting them. If you don't have them now, you will have them instantly.
Well, Holmesians, Sherlockians and Holmesians are fond of the Christmas season. And Bonnie mentioned earlier a story that has been for many years the sort of iconic story, and that's the Blue Carbuncle, which takes place the day after Christmas, takes place on Boxing Day, at least some of the events do. And I know that many Sherlockians have a tradition of not reading A Christmas Carol aloud, but reading The Blue Carbuncle aloud at Christmas. You know, it just sort of seems like Holmes is someone that at the holidays, you know, around a fire and a fire. This is hard to imagine in Arizona, Barbara, I know, but you know, a crackling fire in a fireplace and one's pipe and slippers and Sherlock Holmes, you know, it just sort of seems to go together. So I think Bonnie's story fits right into that. It's got the same sort of heartwarming. I think I said something like that in my blurb. I don't remember.
You did. And you know, it's interesting because I set out to do that. I wanted it to be a Christmas bonbon, but I didn't want it to be saccharine and really, really sweet. But I wanted it to have a comfort level to it that.
Well,
it,
right. It's like, well, Christopher Morley famously said about The Blue Carbuncle, he described it as a Christmas story without slush. Yes. And that sort of seems to be necessary with Holmes. One of my other favorites, I should mention, it is a graphic novel. It's called The Season of Forgiveness by Martin Powell. And it's a lovely short story about Holmes and Watson at Christmas. I won't spoil it, but if one can find it, it's worth reading. So do we have listener questions?
We do. Patrick is going to pop back up in that white space and let us know if we have any questions.
Great.
We do. And also I wanted to point out, we just got very limited supply of this beautiful Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde limited.
Oh, well, bless you.
Yeah, that came from Mysterious. And it's got Les's signature. And then some unknown guy named Joe Hill. I'm not sure who he is, but
wrote a wonderful introduction.
That is a special connection to the Poison Pen, because when we had our 30th anniversary party and Joe Hill came and Leslie came, we sort of did a mob thing on Joe Hill and said, you know, you really ought to do this. And he was great enough to do it. So I'm glad those copies came. That's wonderful, Les, because I told you we sold out at the other edition.
Great. Well, those are beautiful. They're just gorgeous. This is another Penzler special, Bonnie, and they're beautiful.
I'm gonna order it immediately. Yeah. He does beautiful, beautiful editions. Yes.
Well, you have a trade edition sitting at your home here. So okay. Yes.
Thank you.
So Patrick,
yeah,
what do you got?
Let's see here. All right. Madeline has two questions for Bonnie. Number one is, why a Christmas story in the first place? She says, I love Christmas stories, so I'm really looking forward to this. And two, do you ever think you'll try to do something set in the conflict between Holmes and Moriarty? I feel like you'd handle it really excellently.
Oh, thank you. So the answer to the first question, why Christmas? I love Christmas myself, and Christmas is just such a thing here in England. I mean, there's just, everything turns very Christmassy. It's like, it's already, the lights have gone up actually yesterday. They're starting to go up in the shopping areas. But I don't know, I just feel like the juxtaposition of, you know, some combination of the enforced jollity of it, which would grate on Sherlock Holmes, is a good source of humor. But also the fact that he's actually an extremely good-hearted man. I mean, in spite of his prickliness and his sarcasm and his, you know, adherence to scientific reasoning and his, you know, all this stuff, He's actually a very good-hearted man, and I love the opportunity to put that in context, but without, you know, and also I thought it would be a good time to sort of show the difference between the two friends. You know, Holmes, you know, Watson, you know, is married at this time. He, you know, they're going to have turkey. They're going to be at home. They're going to do, you know, or goose or whatever. They're going to invite friends, and they're going to, it's like, have what we think of as a normal life, but not Holmes. And that is, there's just something kind of poignant about that. And I don't know. So it just seemed like something I really wanted to write about. And the answer, Moriarty, I haven't yet put Moriarty into, I've alluded to him. He's kind of in the background in a couple of them. Like there's a presence possibly, but no, I haven't put him in yet. I might.
You might. So while we're talking.
Good idea.
Look at this, guys. While you're talking about Christmas lights.
Yeah, there you go.
We had this done yesterday. Mm-hmm. Isn't it great?
It's beautiful.
Christmas swirl, right. And interestingly enough, I used to think that we didn't want to do any decorations for the house or the store till the day after Thanksgiving, because they thought Christmas had kind of like overwhelmed it. But now it seems like, you know, Halloween, and then bang, all of a sudden November and December are really the holiday month. So this company actually offered you a special deal if you agreed to have your lights put on by the 28th of October. And I thought, really? That seems so early. But then when I was driving home last night, I observed that the lights are on all over the place, not just, you know, not just our Saguaro, but everywhere. Well,
we need some cheer. We all, honestly, as
that's right.
We,
that's
we right. need some. We do need some cheer.
My gauge is always Costco. You can count on it. You know, you go to Costco in the first week of the month of October, and there's going to be holiday gifts. So
it's just too soon for me.
That's a little early. Well, soon there'll be Valentine's out there.
Right. New Year's cards, exactly.
Not until after New Year's Day. I mean, you just have to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, you do.
Another question for you both is regarding other favorite Holmes pastiches. There are so many of them, and there have been over the years. So in addition to yours, Bonnie, do you have any favorites?
I do, but I have to say that once I started writing my series, I stopped reading them because I didn't want another person's imitation voice to be in my ear. I wanted to only have the original voice of Conan Doyle's Watson in my ear. So I stopped reading them. But I've loved all the movies. I loved some of the adaptations. I liked House. I thought House was Sherlock Holmes dead on. And I loved in the 70s I liked Nick Meyer's movie, you know, The 7% Solution. I was actually at Universal when that movie was made. So I love that movie, and I love the story of it and that book. But I, like I said, I haven't been reading the recent ones just because it feels like the wrong thing for me to do, craft.
Well, so it's not going to spoil me. So I do read occasionally, but I generally always preface this by saying I don't really like pastiche. I don't seek it out, and I really read very narrowly in pastiche. I read Bonnie's, I read Nicholas Meyer, and his whole series is quite good, and Lindsay Fay, who has written the brilliant novel Dust and Shadow, and a number of short stories about Holmes that are terrific. My all-time favorite, however, is a novel called The Giant Rat of Sumatra by Richard Boyer. Not easy to find. I think it's been out of print for quite a while, but it picks up the events of The Hound of the Baskervilles. It picks up immediately at the close of the events of The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Well, here's an interesting one. Robin asks, she says, I'm happy to hear Bonnie talk about getting out and about and balancing COVID caution. And she says, a talented friend in Carefree, Arizona, was speaking of an art show coming up. Barbara, you seem very busy. Do you get to enjoy such local events? And then same question for Les and Bonnie. What do you enjoy doing in addition to book research?
My life is circumscribed by the bookstore and by a thoughtfully considered but consuming decision a year ago in August to add two puppies to our household. And I had been out of the mother game for so many years, I forgot how much work it is to have babies. And it is surprising how much time it still takes up. And hilariously, you might all enjoy this because the lady who brought one puppy up, but brought two, the last of the litter, I think in a carefully considered thought that if we took one, we surely couldn't turn down the other, which turned out to be the case. As she was leaving, she looked at me and she said to me, you know, she said, I'm so glad I brought the puppies up. She said, I was just over in Sun City last week and I decided those people were too old to adopt our puppies. And I said to her, how old were they? And she said, well, I think they were about 70. And, you know, I really thought with myself, I thought, am I going to really tell her? So
doesn't need to know. She would have yanked those puppies back.
You know, but what it did make me realize is that it's true that if you adopt something that young, you know, it when you're 80 something, that you have to think about what will happen to them. And so we now have an elaborate arrangement with a trust fund for the puppies. Great. And somebody to change.
Well, as long as you didn't introduce her to Rob, this was, you know, this was going to work. So the minute she saw Rob, she would have said deals off, you know. But oh well.
What kind of puppies are they? What kind of dogs are they?
They're Cavapoos. Though they're litter mates, they are so tall. One's white, one's black, one's sweet, one's not. One of them is muscly. One of them is long and skinny. They both have way too much fur. You know, whatever, but they're just adorable. And, you know, I think it's really healthy to have young things to take care of. It really is, you know, Patrick has dogs and cats. And so we have actually a pot of cats at the bookstore that that we feed and water, and the staff takes turns being responsible for them.
Yep.
Oh, so, there we are. Anyway,
so Bonnie has the luxury of being a full-time writer. I don't. I have a day job that consumes a lot of hours every day. So, getting out.
What you do, Les, just astonishes me that your productivity as a writer and as an editor and as a Sherlockian and you have a whole job. a whole other job. I mean, just astonishing.
This is terrifying. He's really terrifying.
I don't know how you can do it. And then I remember once learning that you often cook dinner too.
Yes, every day.
How do you do this?
It's somebody said vampire. I thought, well, that, you know, could be.
That's just astounding to me. Anyway.
Any other questions?
I've been doing borrow my doggy here. So I doggy sit for people occasionally because I miss my dog so much, who's in LA, that I doggy sit, especially for a little Bichon named Bentley who comes by.
Oh, that's really nice.
And I take care of him sometimes.
That's just about it for questions.
Wonderful. Les, what are you working on? We know that Bonnie has a sixth book coming out, and you've talked earlier before Bonnie joined us about two Library of Congress crime classics, but what massive project do you have in the works?
No massive project yet. I've been pitching them, and you know, it's hard. The kind of, I work the opposite of Bonnie. I don't write the book first and then go to the publisher and say, here it is, and I don't have a multi-book contract. I have to find a publisher who wants to do something. So I've been kicking around various ideas. I don't even want to mention them because they're probably most of them going to die. Meanwhile, the Library of Congress series continues. I just finished working on The Canary Murder Case by S.S. Van Dyne. That was a lot of fun to dive back into the late 1920s and all that. So I'm always filling in those gaps with something. We're talking about another Laurie King, Les Klinger anthology. We'll see. So lots of things all sort of up in the air at the moment.
Wonderful. Well, your productivity puts us all to shame. I have no idea. Absolutely no idea how Les does it. So in any case, Bonnie, it was so lovely to see you. Thank you very much indeed for spending time with us. And Les, thank you for joining us.
Yes, a delight.
Let us wish everybody a happy holiday. And What Child Is This has just come in. And while the British Crime Club people, they're not going to get it till December unless they write indignant letters and say, no, no, we want it now. Everybody else can certainly buy some. We also have some copies coming from London that Bonnie has signed in London. So if you're interested in that, we have those to offer you as well. A perfect Christmas gift. So guys, happy holidays to you.
Thanks, Barbara. Always great to see you.
Thank you.
Great to see you all.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.